You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Tea Break Time Travel, where every month we look at a different archaeological object and take you on a journey into their past.
Hello and welcome to episode 30 of Tea Break Time Travel. I am your host, Matilda Siebrecht. Today I am savouring a rooibos caramel tea because it's late while we're recording this and I don't need any more caffeine, but I still need something a little bit, tougher to get me through the evening, shall we say. And joining me on my tea break today is the one, the only, Raven Todd de Silva, archaeologist, conservator, science communicator, who you might know through her platform, Dig It With Raven. So very welcome, Raven, and what are you drinking today?
Ooh, I am drinking just a fresh, hot ginger tea, actually. Ginger lemon. It's my classic, my go-to.
Yeah, that's a good one. With fresh ginger, I assume?
Yeah, fresh ginger, fresh lemon. Just, good for the immune system. Good for digestion. Everything.
And I'm actually, as I said that, fresh ginger, of course it's going to be fresh. Why would you put like ginger powder? That was a really stupid question.
There's tea bags, the people that have the tea, all of that. Sure.
Yeah. There you go. But you're going full natural ginger chunks, slice of the lemon, honey?
No, not really. I like it bitter. It's really. I can steep it sometimes too. Like I'll boil it down or I'll grate it and really get like a ginger concentrate.
Wow. Okay. That's a great. Good tea choice. So, okay. It sounds like both of us are trying to power through that.
Yeah.
You've got your ginger lemon. I've got my caramel. Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's very exciting to have you on. And I am especially interested to hear your answer to this question. It's a question I ask all my guests, because the road to and within archaeology is wide and varied and everyone walks a different path. So I'm very curious, what was your path? How did you first become interested in this tangled web of archaeology?
Oh, goodness. I feel like it's such a very typical answer, but...
There haven't been any typical answers on this one, to be fair. Everyone said something different.
I feel like mine just is very like that quintessential, like, I think I was 3-4 years old, and you get interested in this like one video from the public library that you're just taking out over and over and over again. And it was the story of Bellerophon and the Pegasus. And it was like a cartoon. I don't think a 3-year-old should have been watching that, but I definitely was. And somehow I don't know how I kept taking it out of the library, but I think it must've been like every other week. It was just, I'd bring it back. I'd go back on the shelf. I'd get it out again. And I just loved watching it. And then, very, very, very quickly after that became obsessed with ancient Egypt, as I feel like most young kids do who get into archaeology, and the pyramids and King Tut, of course. And it just kind of stuck for a really long time. And I was it like, since I was like 6, I was like, I want to be an archaeologist. Didn't even think I knew what the word meant really at that time, but I wanted to go to Egypt and dig up the cool things. I loved going to the Royal Ontario Museum, shout out to the ROM in Toronto, Ontario, the best museum in the world. And it was just always so awe-inspiring, I guess, for me. So yeah, it's been one of those stupid things where I've just been sucked in right from the start into the MLM, I guess, or something.
But was your specialism also in ancient Egypt, or which direction did you go in at the beginning?
So I did start in ancient Egypt. So I did my bachelor was sort of like Roman and Egyptian archaeology. I did the whole hieroglyphs classes.
Very cool.
It was one of the hardest classes I think I've ever done, but probably the one that I've actually put the most effort into, surprisingly. So that was nice. And then I kind of transitioned at some point. So I thought, well, I don't like digging up thing was, especially in Canada, like going on digs and things was extremely difficult and expensive as a student, especially. So then kind of pivoted into archaeological conservation. So I was like, well, I'll just deal with all the stuff when it comes out of the ground. That makes more sense. And then I went back because I was like, no, I feel like a fraud. So then I went back into my master's.
Don't worry, you're in a safe space here. You're amongst fellow post-excavation archaeologists.
Yeah, thank you. Especially when I started the YouTube channel, I was just like, nope, I'm a fraud. I'm not a real archaeologist. So I went back and I did another master's intending to do Egyptian archaeology because my conservation master's also focused on like Egyptian limestone bowls from the pre-dynastic. And then something happened during the master's. It was like archaeology and heritage of Egypt and the Middle East. And the Neolithic sort of just like crept up on me in a weird way. Mm-hmm. And now I'm obsessed with Neolithic Southwest Asia. And that is my area of specialty.
Amazing. That is a very specific area of specialism as well, especially for someone who got into ancient Egypt as a start. What was it? Was there a particular site? Was there a particular object that like brought that interest?
They were the plastered skulls. They are just, my weird obsession. I don't know. I wasn't looking for them. I was writing a paper about something completely different. And then someone had just mentioned it in one of the articles I was reading. And I just went, what are you talking about, plastered skulls? Like, what are these things? And then I just became obsessed. Yeah, that ended up being my dissertation. And now I have a board filled with all of the photos and like red string attached to the maps. You look like Pepe Silvia from Always Sunny?
I can't remember the name, but I know what you mean.
That meme from Always Sunny, that is exactly what the board is. And it's just filled with skulls covered in plaster with strange eyes, and it's in my bedroom, which it's very creepy. I have to admit, it's.
I mean, are we really archaeologists if we don't have something random and creepy in our bedroom related to some prehistoric culture?
Related to some weird death thing, exactly. Right. So it's very on brand. But yeah, I love them so much, and everyone looks at them and they go, "Those are really creepy and kind of gross." I'm like, "No, but they're so pretty, and my babies."
Yeah. We should do it. I mean, really, I should have had you on for that. We'll just have to have you on for another episode so we can talk about them because they sound fascinating.
I will 100% talk about those till I'm blue in the face.
Great. I will mark you in for an upcoming episode. So look forward to hearing back about that, everyone. If you want to hear about these plastered skulls, make sure to follow, like, subscribe, etc. And you'll get them eventually. Okay, great. So, okay, it sounds like you've had quite a turnaround in sort of directions taken. I guess not as many as some people have had, but if you could then travel back in time, seeing as you've had such a wide variety of interests, is there a particular point that you would go to in time, or a particular culture, a particular region?
I feel like this changes year to year for me. It's one of those weird ones where I'm just, you can never really, there's just too many fun places to go and to witness. Like, I don't know if I'd want to witness like a key point in history, but more of like the everyday stuff and just seeing like life in general. Like I'm obsessed, a little bit more recent, the Victorian era in the UK, especially they were wild. They're a little bit weird. They were doing some crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. Just intrigued, but like archaeologically speaking, it's a hard one. Like, I've got to go with sometime around Mesopotamia, when the Ziggurat of Ur was at its height, would be like really cool. Mm-hmm. After digging at Troy, I feel like going back there.
I like how you just dropped that in there, just casually after digging at Troy. Sorry.
No big deal.
Very cool, just to say.
It was really fun. But like, not like for the Trojan War bit, but the one that the 1,000 years before where they, when Schliemann found that really big gate and the big ramp, the gates of Troy. And you're like, no, that's actually 1,000 years ahead of time.
Oh.
Love to see that, because that looked really cool. And like working on that. And I was like, that would be a really nice spot. Or I think another one would just be I would really love to go to Peru and just see all of the like pre-Columbian cultures just thriving in the rainforest and stuff. It'd just be so cool.
Oh, okay. So it sounds like you need a sort of round trip ticket, see the world, take a gap year, go back in time to multiple different places, multiple different locations.
Exactly. I need like a time turner from Harry Potter. Yeah. And then just to take me everywhere, because it's so hard for me to decide. I know some people have like exact places where they would want to go, but it's just, I guess, you know, the anthropology side of archaeology, where you just want to experience how people were living all over the place and get down to the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, which is quite nice. And I think I've said this in nearly every episode, how everyone always indeed picks something and it's never a big fancy event. It's always just seeing every day and just sitting and watching people, which I think is quite fascinating. Yeah. It's just why we do archaeology, I guess. Well, thank you very, very much for joining my tea break today. And before we look at today's object, which is not the plastered skulls, I'm sorry to say, but they are head related, one might say. We're going to journey back to around 1000 BC to what we would now call Mexico. Very exciting. First time journeying back to this part of the world. The heat of the day has cooled into a sticky evening as we look out over the rolling hills and the swampy floodplains that surround us. Suddenly, a sound reaches our ears, a rhythmic ringing thump that cuts through the birdsong and the whirring insects. We follow it to emerge into a large clearing dominated by a huge boulder of dark, rough stone. Deep grooves cut into the ground lead away from it to the edge of the clearing, where the piles of rope and stacked wooden portable rails show the manner of its transportation to its current location, for there are no similar rocks nearby. Around the boulder, there are three figures, each one with various tools and hammers, chipping and smashing at the rough stone with clear, strong intent. We stay there for a while, and as the days pass, every chip and groove will deepen and lengthen until finally the boulder will be transformed into a beautifully carved head with a broad nose, wide lips, hooded eyes, and decorated helmet. So today, we're going to look at the Olmec Colossal Heads, which I think is one of my favorite names for anything. We'll get into the details very soon, but first, let's have a very quick break. Welcome back, everybody. So, as always, something that I usually like to look at when we sort of start talking about the objects are the most asked questions on the internet, courtesy of Google search, to see what other people want to find out about the object, because I assume that that's what most people listening in either know about or want to find out about. So, seeing as we have Raven with us here today, who happens to have written a fantastic book featuring a chapter on these colossal Olmec heads, I think we might be able to get some answers. So, the first question, it was actually surprisingly simple with these ones. There were very few questions, and they were all pretty much to the point, along the lines of, what do the Olmec heads represent? Which, I guess, interpret that as you will. So, what answer would you give to that question?
Ooh, okay. So, I guess we can say, like, I'm going to take it very literal of, like, who are the Olmec heads representing? We can go philosophical about it later, but let's go right with the basics. So all of the heads are, you know, very realistic. They're not very idealized. They're unidealized. They're very frank, you know, descriptions, depictions of men. They are likely portraits of living or recently deceased rulers. That's sort of the general consensus nowadays. Okay. They're all very distinct. If you look at them, like they're all, and you can see that they're like definitely portraits of someone because they're very natural looking. They all have individualistic features. So they probably were very well known by the sculptor, you know, like it's a prominent person's face. So that's really cool. At first they were thought to represent ball players. So the Mesoamerican ball game, the very popular ball
like
game.
The ball game, with the stone hip thing and the rings.
Which
totally accurate, right?
That one. I'm not a ball game expert.
So. I'm just thinking of what's that Disney film? Is it El Dorado or something?
Road to El Dorado. So good. Yeah.
Do they play the ball game in that? It's one of those films.
They played a game, I think. Yeah. Maybe I think so.
They took the ball off their hips.
Yeah, they had to bounce it, and get through a thing. I don't know if that's an accurate depiction, I'm going to be honest.
It's definitely an accurate depiction.
But it's definitely a fun depiction. Yeah. And please see the Road to El Dorado cartoon.
I'll add that to the show notes as a reference.
Academic reference.
Very sorry. So the whole, because they would have had to wear helmets because the ball was heavy or something.
Yes. And so you can see in these heads that they have these very distinct helmets. And so they think that they're ball game helmets. Obviously, they could be for war. There's all these theories. Okay. But yeah, so they probably represented or incorporated like the very concept or ideals of Olmec kingship, rulership, power. Mm. Some think that they were, you know, protective. Some think that the heads themselves like possessed the power of the ruler or represent, you know, almost like the Prima Porta, you know, Augustus, where he like put a statue all around the empire to be like, this is my representation of my power, etc.
In case you forget what I look like, here I am.
Exactly. All right. I am always watching. So there's lots of things like that. But yeah, the helmets themselves as well are like very individualistic and distinct. They have some have claws, some have ropes on them. So they're all different, which is really cool.
And have they found any archaeological, I mean, this, I know this sounds very far-fetched, but have they found, you never know, have they found any, for example, archaeological evidence of similar helmets from this region and culture at all?
Not that I am aware of. They would have been made out of leather or some sort of organic material, so it wouldn't have survived. Yeah, there's not a lot surviving in that sort of climate that's organic. It's very lucky. We actually just, they have not, we, I've not been there, but the archaeological we,
yes,
they have found some wooden carvings dating to quite a while ago, actually, like predating the Stoneheads. So they definitely did carve in wood, but yeah, we haven't found any helmets that I'm aware of.
Okay. Oh, that would be the find of a century, which leads nicely into the next question, which we had, which are, where are the Olmec heads located and where were they created? Which, so I mentioned a little bit in the opening, Mexico, trying to keep it very vague. Was that correct? Are they in that region? Are they spread far and wide?
So there are 17 confirmed examples that are in Mexico. There is one, like, possible one that's in Guatemala. But, you know, it's not confirmed yet. It's like a throne that may have been carved from a colossal head. So, you know, it's a little bit damaged. We won't be able to properly confirm it until maybe more science. But we have 10 in San Lorenzo. We have 10 at the site of La Venta. Sorry, not 10, 4 at the site of La Venta, 2 at another site called Tres Zapotes, and another one at a site called La Cobata. So those are like the main areas where they're located. Where were they made? So all of the 17 confirmed ones, they're all carved from basalt. So it's like a very hard stone. And that stone came from the Sierra de los Tuzlas Mountains in Veracruz. Hmm. It's a very like coarse grained, dark gray basalt called Cerro Sintepec basalt. And that's sort of like found on the southeastern slopes of the mountains. And, you know, and you find a
like
boulder.
A very specific location. Like
very specific.
Wow.
It's amazing. Yeah, you can see, yep, they exactly came from here, but they all came from one spot, which is interesting. Oh. So they were like, this is the place to get the head rocks.
Yes. We need another head rock. Where should we go? Yeah. Well, let's go back to the volcano.
Exactly. Let's go to these mountains. We're going to find some stuff and we're going to do it. But that means that, you know, these boulders had to be transported sometimes over 150 kilometers from the source of the stone.
Wow. Okay.
So crazy. Yeah. And we don't know how they did it.
Well, because of the vegetation, I mean, I'm picturing it as like jungle. But
yeah.
And they were moving these massive stones.
Yeah, jungle, mountains, rivers, 150 kilometers. They didn't have beasts of burden. They didn't have the wheel.
Okay.
So, just moving that is a feat.
Rolling in and hoping for the best. Maybe that's why they're spread so sporadically. It's just like, right, let's roll in this direction. Oh, no, that entry tree. Oh, that went down the river. Oh, okay, so that's why it's in Guatemala. They're like, oh, blast.
And it is now here. It is where it stays. But there's thoughts of like using water transport, so different sorts of rafts, but like some of the heads, they weigh really like a lot. Okay. It's quite impractical to move it over, obviously over water, but it's not improbable. Just like the Pyramid of Giza, moving stones over water, it's possible.
Possible, yeah.
But then eventually, obviously, you have to like go over terrain at some point. And that would have been probably just like moving it on logs and other ramps and things. But there's swamps, there's floodplains, there's undulating hills. They, you know, luckily they had causeways and ramps and roads, but can you imagine just like the earthworks that they had to make to just help make, like, facilitate the moving of these giant boulders?
Yeah. Where were the boulders? I mean, I'm picturing just a random head in the middle of kind of nowhere, but you mentioned that like one of them was carved into a throne and they're sort of as outkeeps. Are they always next to settlements? Are they kind of guarding somewhere? Is there any sort of pattern to where they're located?
So this is where it gets kind of interesting and weird. And we actually don't know because we found them in so many different contexts and we think that they're not in their original actual, like, where they were first put. Mm. It's also, someone has theorized that they've actually been moved throughout, like the Olmecs themselves moved them around.
Got it.
So who knows? There's one theory where there was four of them at the Venta, and they were placed sort of like around this precinct, like a religious precinct almost. And they were all facing outwards. So they're like, it was put there for protection.
Someone had seen Atlantis.
Probably, you know, who knows, right? But like, they're thinking like, oh, it's some sort of like position for stand as guardians of the sacred precinct of the city. Got and it. Protecting it.
Which, so, I guess, like, you see in other cultures as well, right? Like with the
like
on the outside and
Like markers or things, like protection things. Hmm. Others are like, oh, they were moved to other settlements around the neighborhood to be like, I'm your ruler now. But yeah, and then some of them were buried around 900 BC, and they've all been found in different contexts, which is an issue.
That's really,
and some are half buried, some are buried facing up. So they're like, well, is that like a purposeful burial? Is it not? Did it just fall over? Because they all have the flat backs. They're all kind of flat on the back, which is quite interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not round. You can just like tip them over and they won't roll away.
That'd be flooding. Interesting.
Yeah.
And that's why they were carved into thrones, I guess. You mentioned there was one or two of carved thrones.
So yeah, some were recarved from these massive stone thrones.
As in you had a stone throne and then you would get the head.
Yes. So that the flat back is something that like may have been attributed to this. Like four don't have it. Don't have this like flat back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it could be like some sort of like stone recycling.
Yeah.
Okay. But also people think the flat back could have been for transporting, like securing ropes. It's a lot easier to have something with a flat back than a very round thing to transport.
Yeah.
So, you know, it could, you know, it's one of those things where is it practical or is there an actual purpose to it?
Interesting. Or is it just, because that was what the original object was made from that they carved it out of. So, interesting. Very cool. And so I must admit, I have heard of the Aztecs. I've heard of the Mayans. I've heard of the Incans. I had never heard of the Olmec culture. Who were the Olmec culture? When did they live? What were their relationships with these other South American cultures? Or Mesoamerican, I should say.
Oh, the Olmec are so cool. So they are regarded as the first civilization to develop in Mesoamerica.
Okay.
They're one of the first people in the Americas to develop a sophisticated style of stone sculpture. They may have been the first civilization in the Western Hemisphere to develop a writing system.
Oh, okay.
Which is very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just, I think they are definitely one of the unsung heroes, which is why I wanted to highlight them, obviously, in a book that highlights unsung heroes of ancient history. They are also a very strong candidate for originating the Mesoamerican ball game.
Okay.
So the rubber ball, we found some rubber balls dating to 1600 BCE or even earlier. Yeah, they were found in a bog. Bogs are great for finding organic materials. We love that. Yeah. So that was really cool. But they've just done so much. They have like beautiful sculptures of like were-jaguars, which I love that it's just like a were-jaguar baby.
Were-jaguar.
Yeah, it's just like a baby that looks, it's like a anthropomorphic small person, but like with a creepy jaguar head and like fangs and like a little dent in that. It's just, it's such a fun thing. But they made like, they did a lot of greenstone, you know, mosaics. They did a lot of that kind of stuff first that you kind of always attribute Mesoamerican cultures with, with, you know, the jade, the serpentine.
Yeah, yeah.
They made these really great big pyramids and ceremonial mounds.
Okay, they were doing that even all the way back.
Yeah, okay. They were at urban centers. They had royal compounds. It was first settled around the first like major city, San Lorenzo. It's a hilltop settlement. And they settled around 1800 BCE, and it was a full-blown urban city by 1200 BCE. It was essentially, you know, Mesoamerica's first city, as we said, and it was the capital of the region. It's just really crazy to think about this, the art form starting that early, especially in that part of the, when we don't hear a lot about it in yeah. that part of the world. And, you know, it's nice that it's being highlighted and celebrated.
Yeah. And so you say early. So sorry, what was the, or like, do they know what the kind of starting point would have been for the Olmec culture date-wise?
Yeah, so around 1800 BCE is sort of when okay. the first big city kind of came around.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So that was in the San Lorenzo. That was at San Lorenzo. That was first settled, but then it became like a big thing around like 1200. So that's sort of like the biggest, like, yes, that is the start of the archaeological culture, 1200 BCE to 400 BCE. And we get their name from actually the Aztecs, which is really cool. Yeah, so they dubbed the area that they, the Olmec Heartland area. It's like a crescent-shaped region of southern Veracruz and western Tabasco that kind of hugs the Gulf of Mexico. Uh-huh. They called it Olman or Ulman, which means the land of rubber in their Nahuatl language. And then they referred to the people who inhabited the region as the Olmeca or the Olmeca. And that's where we get Olmec. Yeah.
So rubber is also an important, well, actually, I see that we're going to talk about your book a bit later, but I can see indeed that this chapter is entitled Olmec, Land of Rubber and Colossal Stone Heads. So it's, I mean, those are the two main exports of the Olmec culture.
So that's it. We don't know much really. Like we found some rubber in a bog that dates to around 1600 BCE, but we don't know much about the Olmec people, like who created the Olmec art. We mostly know them from their art. That's it. Like it's one of those cultures where we know mostly from the art form. But some scholars have proposed that they were migrants from the Pacific coast of Chiapas to the south, and they brought with them very early social stratification and upgraded strains of corn and maize. Okay. But of course, others believe it evolved from a local indigenous population. So again, it's the Olmec, that's why they don't get as much of attention as I think they deserve. It's just very difficult to describe a lot of the time if you're doing like a popular history show.
Yeah. And were they mentioned by like the colonizers coming in and everything? Would they? Because I know that I guess that's where we have the majority of the references to like the Mayans and stuff is from the kind of colonial histories. But were the Olmecs still around at that point, or had they kind of vanished out, or how did that?
You know, they were way too early. So like the traditions and the social rituals and things, like they start as early as 1700 BCE.
Okay.
And then it kind of ends around 400 BCE.
Oh, okay.
At like so the latest. Before. So way before the Europeans even thought about what's on the other side of the ocean, probably.
Okay. Yeah.
But it didn't really disappear. Like there's the rise of another culture called the Epi-Olmec.
Okay.
They sort of evolved with the changing of the tide. So like the descendants obviously drew upon the symbols and iconographies of the Olmec and adapted them into new sculptural political traditions. And that sort of went on a little bit further. But they definitely like started that ritual use of rubber, probably. They had a special calendar that they made.
They also had a calendar.
It's just they had everything. It was like the development of the Mesoamerican calendar, possibly. Like they're the OGs, I want to say, of Mesoamerican cultures and civilizations. And then from there, you know, you get the Maya, the Aztec, everybody. And it kind of sort of just like bleeds out from that.
Yeah, but they've somehow just, fallen under the radar a little bit, which I'm curious, sort of final question before we have a break, is heads. I mean, it seems to be a very specific kind of thing to carve. Was it always just heads, or did they have, because I can remember vaguely somewhere seeing something where like the Maui on Rapa Nui were actually, some of them did have a little body or some kind of thing, but are these ones indeed just heads?
The big boys are just heads.
Just heads.
Just heads. So they did other carvings. They had, you know, the big stone altars, the big stone thrones. There's votive axes, which are those were-jaguars, greenstone carvings, giant mosaic pavements. But like the heads themselves were just heads. Wow. Just floating heads.
Yeah. I mean, it's a choice. It's a decision to decide. We're going to just focus on the heads, guys. This is all we can do, which I suppose, I mean, if you say that they're really identifiable, like they're so specific, each particular head, I guess the face is the most identifiable aspect of someone. So,
well, that's it. And we can see that throughout so many cultures around the world and throughout the giant space span of history, right? It's the importance of the head, the seat of power and mortality and vanity and presence and all of these things that you can just so much more, like you can convey so much more within like a head and a face than you can any other part of the body.
True. Very true. Very true. Well, ponder on that, everyone. We're going to have another quick break now so that everyone has an opportunity to top up their tea, but we will be back very soon. Welcome back, everyone. Hope the teacups are now fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So, after introducing us so beautifully to the Olmec colossal heads, let's go a little bit back to you and your sort of experience in archaeology, Raven, because we did already introduce you a little bit in the first section, but maybe we could go into a bit more detail now. So a lot of people listening, if they recognize your name, may recognize it because of the very successful digital platform that you have sort of created for education of archaeology called Dig It With Raven. So I'm very curious, at what point in this path from ancient Egyptologist to conservator to plastered skulls to everything else, when did that develop? And how does the kind of, I guess, the management of that compare to like your day job or your job as an archaeologist?
Wow, so I'm aging myself here now. I just realized how long it's been since I started this thing. It was 8 years ago, August of 2016, that I first got the idea. I had just moved to Germany, to Hamburg, to start my internship for stone conservation. And I had no friends, I couldn't speak the language, and I had $0. It was really scary. It was a very scary year of just like extreme budgeting and like doing weird jobs just to make, you know, just to buy groceries. But my cousin Andrew actually was like, you know what you should do? Nothing else to do. Yeah, pretty much. He was like, you know what? You like archaeology. You're good at talking about it. He's also a big nerd, so I owe this all to him, really. He's like, you should start a YouTube channel. And I was like, I don't know. And I was that kid at school that always, if there was a possibility or an option to make a video to, you know, incorporate into a school project, I was that person.
Right.
I would edit with my VCR on a VHS. Old school times. Again, aging myself here. But I loved it and I had so much fun. So I thought, you know what? This actually sounds like a fun idea. I could try it. So I filmed a first video, like a what is archaeology, like an archaeology 101 video in the Airbnb that I had like booked for like that first little month or so until I was able to get into my student housing. And I did not upload it for a whole year. I just sat on it.
That's the ultimate sleeping on it.
Yeah, it was a very long drawn out process. Just it's overwhelming learning German and during a internship in German, and you're just looking at them like, I don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. You get it. Sometimes you're like, wait, and then everyone else starts to do the stuff, and you nodded, and you're like, oh crap.
You're like, oh shoot.
I should have asked a question, but I didn't want to look stupid. So it just became a big thing like that. And then I think like the next spring, I was like, you know what? I really want to get into it and do it. And it's now, you know, become this big thing. And I feel bad because I haven't been giving it as much attention as it deserves throughout the years. I feel like it could be so much more, you know, just bigger and better for the viewers if I had given it more attention. But I'm very glad and very, you know, grateful for everyone who's kind of been on this journey for the last, you know, 8 years or so. But it's just been this really fun thing. It sort of morphed into, it started off as me wanting to make all of the videos that I wanted when I was an archaeology undergraduate studying for midterms. Mm-hmm. I wanted someone to explain to me what, like how to calculate radiocarbon dating.
Mm. Yeah. We all need that.
Right? I was like, what do you mean? So I wanted those things and like little quick videos of like, what is dendrochronology? What is, you know, luminescence dating? All that stuff. Yeah. So I started off with that. And then it sort of weirdly morphed into like me and my friend Jude watching Indiana Jones and yelling at it.
One of the best videos of all time, must say.
Thank you.
It was so fun to film. And then we've kind of done a whole bunch more. Indiana Jones 4 and 5 are also coming. Spoiler alert.
Excellent.
Yeah, I flew to Hong Kong to do those with Jude because I felt like we had to.
Dedication to the core.
Business expense, get to go to Hong Kong. Oh, goodness. But yeah, it's kind of just become this amazing community. Like, I've met so many people like yourself and just... No. Oh no, it's been so fun that way. Like, I never in a million years thought that we could just sort of make archaeology what we want it to be rather than what some old white man in a blazer at the top of academia says it is.
No.
So that's been really cool. And, you know, bringing that information to the public and learning along the way of like how best to tell a story and how to disseminate this information properly and to just connect with people and get them excited about the ancient world and not just, you know, the conspiracy theories or the big gold things, but like the actual history and people living their normal everyday lives like us and realizing like, you know, we're not that different from people in the past. And here's this cool thing that we can do. So, yeah, but, you know, having this channel up next to a full-time job has been very stressful, but hopefully we'll find the right balance at times. I have not posted in a year. I apologize, but the videos are starting next week. So,
and the reason you haven't been posting for a year, glad you mentioned it, because I was going to mention you have a book coming out. One of the chapters I've already mentioned is called The Olmec Land of Rubber and Colossal Stoneheads, which now those listening in will know what we mean by that. They'll know a little bit about the Colossal Stoneheads. But yeah, a book about the kind of the lost ancient, the forgotten ancient cultures, shall we say. Where did the inspiration for that come from? Why did you decide to write a book?
Weirdly enough, I did not really, it wasn't my like thing where I woke up and I was like, I'm going to write a book. I very fortunately had a publisher reach out to me, which is, you know, very rare.
Very cool, yeah.
Yeah, just to be like, hey, you want to write a book? And I was like, I don't know.
Do you want me to write a book?
I was like, maybe. And then I sat down and I was like, okay, like, if I'm going to write a book, and obviously, like, they reached out because they found my YouTube channel. So I was like, it's obviously going to be a book for the community, not just for myself. Yeah. And I was like, what would I want, you know, people who happen upon my videos or are interested in things that I talk about, or like, you know, a lot of other archaeologists online talk about, like, what is a really good one that's different, that's not overdone, and sort of highlights the archaeological bits of it, not the fantastical historical stuff, as sometimes, you know, that we can kind of get wrapped up in these stories. And I just went, okay, well, what about like a collection of lesser known and like under celebrated ancient civilizations and cultures from all around the world? And, you know, everything is very much, you know, when I was growing up, especially when you're taking books out about ancient history and stuff, it's very Eurocentric. It's very Mediterranean centric as well. Or, you know, you get a little bit of the Middle East sometimes. And you'll get Egypt, but you won't get anything south of Egypt.
Right.
So I thought, well, let's be ambitious, which came to bite me. But I'm proud of how it ended up. But gosh, it was such a feat. But
well, there's a lot in here. I'm just having a little look through the contents that you sent me again. And I mean, you've got the Akkadians, you've got the Hittites, but you've also got the Jomon, the Minoans, Mississippians, the Nok. No idea what that is. Very curious to hear about that.
Oh, the Nok are cool. Yeah. The Nok of Nigeria. That's like, you know. Yeah, they're from Nigeria. We got Great Zimbabwe in there. We have the Lapita of Oceania. We've got the Moche. So it was like me just kind of going, let's try and make it around the world. I was literally going crazy in front of a map. I had like a list of 50 that I wanted to write about. I looked at a map and I started pinning them to make sure I could get as many regions as possible and that it's not evenly distributed. I will say I tried my best, but, you know, we did what we could with what we had. And It will hopefully be a really nice representation of cultures from all around the world that are from various points. We have the Neolithic all the way up to, you know, the early Inuit, the Tule, which go down, you know, to pretty much, you know, a couple hundred years ago, right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to,
I know that one. That one I know.
That date is failing me. But like, you know, so we have people, you know, ones that come into contact with European colonizers and stuff in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s. So it covers around, I think I did the math, it was 15,000 years of history.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. And it took me a year to write while doing a full-time job. And that's why I haven't been posting. But I think it turned out okay. Like, I thought if I'm going to write a book, like, I'm going to write a book. And so it ended up being a lot bigger. I took on 20. I don't know if 20 was a smart idea for someone who was writing a book for the first time. And I really hope I did them justice, because I was definitely out of my comfort zone for a lot of them. But I really tried. And so I hope that it comes across that way. And that I really wanted to just get that story out there for them and to like kind of just go, this is a really good jumping off point. If you want to look further, go into the bibliography, because it's huge. And enough sources.
And I mean, even in the introduction, you already, you know, specify that and say that, like, this is just supposed to be almost like an introduction to these cultures. And I love indeed the full name, which is, let me find the Other Ancient Civilizations, Decoding Archaeology's Less Celebrated Cultures. And I think that that's a really nice way of putting it. The kind of, and as we're talking about with the Olmec, I mean, they're just not really as well known as other kind of Mesoamerican cultures, even though they have all these amazing things on their CV. And it's kind of something that, should be celebrated indeed, and they shouldn't be forgotten. So I think that, it's a really nice way of celebrating them, and a way of remembering them, I guess, in the modern time.
Yeah.
Which, do you have a favorite chapter that you had to research?
Ooh, making me pick one of my favorite babies. To say, you know, like, I love them all the same. No. I think some of them, you know, were clear, obviously, you know, as with all books, some are a lot easier to write than others. Some just kind of come off the page because you just know exactly how you're going to write about them. And I think for me, one of my favorite ones was, I'm going to make sure I pronounce this right because I never do. I believe it's the Unetice. The Unetis. I can never say it correctly. I feel really bad every time I say it. It's a Czech word. So that's why I can't pronounce very well. But like Unetice, I think, is the closest I'll get. But they are from sort of like that middle Europe. So Germany, Czech Republic, Poland type area. Mm-hmm. Do you know the Nebra Sky Disc?
I do know the Nebra Sky Disc, yes.
They made the Nebra Sky Disc.
Oh, they made the Nebra Sky Disc. See, didn't know that.
And they are just so cool. I love it. They have like these beautiful, amazing like burials. They have these amazing like settlements, and they have, I want to call it like the German Stonehenge, essentially. It's called Pumelte.
Okay.
It's in central Germany, so it's not far from you, maybe.
I was about to say, I should know about this.
It's really cool. They were like the bronze masters of, you know, that time period, and they were dealing in amber beads, and they had like the mines, and so they became like really powerful during that time in Europe for them, which was, you know, like around 2300 BC, like Bronze Age, you know, early Bronze Age, 2300 to 1600. And they were just really fun. And I loved writing about them because I knew about the Nebra Sky Disc and I was so excited to learn more about it. And then just for me, it was, you know, knowing that, but then learning more about like, you know, the burials and the bronze and the trade. And I went, oh, that's actually like really, they're much more interesting than I thought they were going to be.
Yeah.
And another favorite, I think, is the Nok from Nigeria, their pottery. So nice. So cool. So well done. we barely know much about them, but like we found them, the first heads were found in like a tin mine and everyone was like, what? And then we don't know what they were used for. Like there's some theories. I'm not going to spoil the whole book, but they're really cool.
Yeah. More heads, more fancy
heads. More fancy heads. But these ones have bodies this time.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah. And the, you know what? The Lapita, I need to just give a little shout out to the Lapita in Oceania. They, you know, we're thinking like people didn't cross big bodies of water for, you know, until recently. And they were going out on these like tiny canoes to know, to, you know, to the Solomon Islands.
Right. Yeah.
And you're like, what? Okay. Go. Yeah. You do you, babe. But like, I wouldn't be the volunteer to go like, yeah, we're just going to go on a canoe and see how far we get until we find land.
Let's see what happens. What's the worst that could happen?
Right. But it's just, yeah, that human spirit of like, what's out there? And I'm just going to get on my tiny boat and see what we can find. Yeah. It's just amazing.
I mean, yeah, I can't wait to read up about all of these cultures in it, which if other people listening in also want to read it, when will it be released? Where can people get hold of it?
You can pre-order it on all of the Amazons,
okay,
from what I've seen. So you can, any country you're in, go on Amazon. Okay. It comes out pretty much everywhere October 29th. So just, I guess, pre-Halloween reading.
Why not?
There's nothing spooky, but you know.
Okay. Want to learn about those heads?
Exactly. We love some good heads.
Nice. And where can people buy it?
Amazon. You can get it at Waterstones. Where else have I seen it? I think it's on Indigo if you're a Canadian woodwood, and Barnes and Noble, of course. Okay. But yeah, just I would say, like, you know, when in doubt, as even though we don't really all want to support Amazon, but when in doubt, Amazon's got it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Great. Well, I look forward to reading it. Look forward to others telling me about their exciting journey. That marks the end of our tea break today. Probably time to get back to work. It sounds like if you've been working on this for a year, you probably have a lot of other stuff to catch up on. But thank you so, so much for joining me today, Raven. I really enjoyed our chat today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun to just always fun to chat with you. So,
oh shucks, and yeah, I'm definitely going to have you on again to chat about every single one of these cultures in the books.
Well, okay. Watch out, 20 new episodes coming your way.
Sorted, content sorted. So, if anyone wants to find out more about Raven's work or her platform as well, or indeed the Olmec Colossal Heads, do check the show notes on the podcast homepage and make sure to check on, I guess, Raven's social media and all kinds of other places. Keep an eye on Amazon and other places you get books to pre-order the other ancient civilizations. Hope that you all enjoyed our journey today. If you want to help support this show and, of course, all of the other amazing series that form the Archaeology Podcast Network, make sure to like, follow, subscribe, etc. Wherever you get your podcasts, follow us on social media to get updates on new episodes and upcoming events. And if you want to be extra, extra nice and support us even further, you can always become an APN member. You'll be helping us to create even more amazing, free, fun content, and you will also have exclusive access to ad-free episodes and bonus content like our online seminars and live read-along events. For more information, check out the homepage at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you did, make sure to like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.